Hello and welcome to Who Are Your Talks. In this episode, I speak to Daniel Gray, author of Black Boots and Football Pinks, 50 Lost Wonders of the Beautiful Game. We speak about that book, the inherent geekishness of following football, and things we love and hate about how the game has changed. Hope you enjoy it. First question is always the same for every guest we have on. Who are you?
I don't know. Do you know, I was thinking about that song the other day, how it used to be Who the Effing Hell Are You and seems to be Who Are You Now, doesn't it? Which is some sort of evolution in football. But I am Daniel Gray, I think, and I'm a writer. I write books mainly on football, but on a number of other topics as well, and do various other things to earn my crust.
And what are your kind of earliest memories of getting into football and falling in love with it?
Well, like so many people, it had everything to do with my dad. And 30 years ago next month, it's November 2018 as we speak, 30 years ago next month, my dad took me to see my local team, the Middlesbrough. I was born on Teesside. That day in December, I was just about to turn seven, and we drew 3-3 with Aston Villa. And I remember being... getting a squeeze, as they call it on Teesside, or a lift over into the Holgate end, and I remember that green in front of me. And to an extent, I was sold from then. But my dad was actually a Leeds fan, and we moved down to New York, so he also took me to see Leeds to give me this kind of choice. But they drew 0-0 against Oldham Athletic, and I think I probably plumped for the high scoring game above anything more than that, really. And then, like so many people, what solidified my love of the game was a World Cup. World Cup 90, I vividly recall being properly excited by, of course, everything around Gaza. Gaza has so much to blame, really, for, I think, a lot of people my age, because we just fell for the game with his mesmerising footwork in that World Cup, and I had the Gaza bed covers and all of that stuff. So that period, early years, before I was 10, already fallen for the game.
So you mentioned that you moved to Leeds at a young age. How did that affect how you supported Middlesbrough then?
Well, it was nearer York than Leeds, actually, so... And yet I already knew I was a Borough fan. I think the colour red, the fact that all the other kids at school supported Leeds, I think I liked being slightly different, albeit I was permanently bullied about it, really, for a long, long time, till the mid-90s when we had our great years. It just meant I've always travelled for games. Back then it was going in the car with my dad. Now I live in Edinburgh, so it's going down on the train. So I've never really had a proper home game with Middlesbrough. But at the same time, being near York, usually York City would alternate and I'd be able to go and see both. So I also watched an awful lot of York City in the 1990s, including seeing them beat Man United over two legs in the cup and seeing them beat Man City in the league, which is 20 years ago next month as well, which is quite remarkable when you think about where those two are now.
Yeah, absolutely. I'm another one with a soft spot for York City.
Right.
When I went to uni in Leeds, I used to pop along to York City games and saw them go for a playoff push in League Two. And it's ever since I've sort of had them as a second or third team. They've fallen down the leagues.
And I think it's Bootham Crescent that I fell for in the same way that I fell for Ayresome Park. And sometimes I think I support football grounds as much as I support football teams and like football, really. It's very much about those often dilapidated homes, of which there are fewer and fewer these days. And of course, Bootham Crescent will see the wrecking ball next summer, it seems like.
We'll move on to talk about stadiums in a bit.
Yeah.
But obviously, Bootham Crescent, and one of the things you raise in your book is not knowing what grounds are called anymore.
Exactly.
Bootham Crescent had an ill-fated spell as Kit Kat Crescent, of course. So, growing up then, what were your kind of standout memories of following your teams, whether it's a particular game or maybe it didn't have to maybe revolve around what happened on the pitch, but any standout memories of being a football fan at that age?
There are several, really, because... The 1990s is the period, really, that I seem to hark back to a lot. And, you know, I reached my teens in that era. And I think you never quite care as much about football or care as much about anything as you do in your teens. And don't get me wrong, I'm obsessed with the game now and I go to games every week still. I'm completely besotted with football still. But it's it's in that time that most of my memories come through. So right from the 25th of March 1990, going to watch Middlesbrough in their first Wembley appearance in the Zenith Data Systems Cup, and a 1-0 defeat to to Chelsea via a Tony DiRigo goal. There are staging points throughout the 1990s because Borough were promoted and relegated so many times, but particularly that very middle period where we left Ayresome Park, and I vividly remember running onto the pitch after that and trying to get Alan Moore, the left winger's shirt, and him saying he needed it for the game the next week. And just recently, in fact, I watched the highlights of that and spotted my classic 1990 step haircut running in front of the Hallgate end, both embarrassing and proud of that. And for that was a real catalyst. Though I love these grounds, as we'll come to, I understand why Middlesbrough left Ayresome Park, and from 95 being at the Riverside Stadium gave me so many memories from that. From going to watch the ground being built, I vividly remember going to see the ground being built with my dad and my granddad, and there were an awful lot of people, hundreds and thousands, visited every day when the Riverside was going up. And so I remember my first walking up the steps for the first game against Chelsea at the Riverside, Thank You for the Days by the Pretenders was playing, and the Lightning Seeds, who are very much the mid-90s football band, I think. From then on, they just created memory after memory. Of course, the signing of Janino the season after, when they got to the two cup finals and were relegated, and then the year after that, back up, another cup final, another defeat to Chelsea in a cup final. Not long after, under Steve McLaren, European football, winning a trophy for the first time in our 128-year history. There was just memory after memory after memory, right up until Eindhoven, when we lost in the UEFA Cup final. And being there felt really like, in a sense, the end of a journey. And it was really, because I haven't really hit those heights again since. But I'm so incredibly privileged to have been there and been to so many cup finals, even if we only won one of them.
You mentioned how you're still besotted with the game. And I want to ask you, kind of gradually moving on to the book, then, how has your kind of experience of being a football supporter changed as you've got older and maybe not been as perhaps emotional about it as you were as a teenager? Or has the way you kind of consume football changed anything for you?
Well, I go through these regular periods of disillusionment like a lot of fans, and I just have to find ways of renewing myself. So it'll be about a new, you know, news coming through of huge wages, or the FA Cup being spread, FA Cup third round being spread over 4 or 5 days that year. So I have to find different ways of renewing it, I would say. So whether that's going to lower division football, Scottish League football, there are many different ways. But the biggest crisis really in all of that I went through was 3 years ago, when indeed that happened with the FA Cup third round. And to cut a long story short, I started to write down a list of what I still liked about football, and pitched it as a book idea. So that became a book called Saturday 3 p.m, my previous football book to this new one. And that was a reaffirmment of why I bother. So it was all of these little things, the minutiae of the game, things like seeing a ground from the train, talking to an old man about football, all of the different things that I am still in love with. So I do have to renew my faith now and again. And in those 30 years of going, I don't think football has changed to a greater degree in any time in its, you know, 150-year or whatever history. I think this has been the most immense period of change. Of course, that first season of mine was the season of Hillsborough as well. So I hope in the new book I don't make out that everything was better then. I'm not sort of grumpy old man about that. I'd far rather be taking my daughter to games in the situation we have now, where it's safe and everything, which I do, than the situation in which my dad was taking me to my early games. As a spectacle, I may miss standing, but I am well aware of how much nicer it is as a clean and safe experience when you're taking your 8 year old along.
I'm so glad you mentioned spotting football grounds from trains, because it's kind of reassuring when you talk to other football obsessives that they do the same things you do. I mean, I'll often message my football supporting mate saying, "I'm on this train going from here to here. What football grounds can I see?" from the train, yeah, and they'll be like guessing and I mean, and that things
one,
like that.
That was the first one in Saturday 3 p.m. and I thought it was so geeky. I thought, oh God, am I really going to admit I do this? And it must have had the biggest reaction of any of them. Like you say, people trying to work out which railway line allows you to see the most grounds. And there were a few of them in that book. Like when I wrote about getting the fixture list in the summer, I didn't realise what a day it was for so many of us. All of these things that you suddenly realise you're not alone. And I think, you know, there's ones like spotting a fellow supporter elsewhere, that thing when you're on holiday and you see someone with your team's top on, and physiotherapist races and all of these different things that I thought were unique to me, but it turns out happily so many people recognise themselves in them, which is a lovely thing. It bonds you to supporters of all teams, really.
Yeah, we'll talk about some of the delights of modern football in a bit. I've just remembered an occasion. I'm a Stoke fan, and we were going to Tottenham away at Wembley, and there was a dad and his lad doing the kind of the same thing of looking out the train window from Preston and seeing what grounds he could spot, and he points at Wigan's DW Stadium, which you can see along that route, and the kid just goes, oh, Wembley.
Oh, that is tremendous. That, I mean, that says so much, doesn't it?
we'll get on to hopefully geeky stuff like that soon. But on the most recent book then, Black Boots and Football Pinks, you write early on, my supporting life has straddled two worlds, old and new football. I am guilty of glorifying the former and tutting at the latter. In what ways then do you think the overall fan experience, you kind of alluded to it there, what way has it changed for the better?
For the better, certainly... the view you get without having to very often extend yourself above the fella in front of you on the terraces and things like that. The safety, that word family, it's undoubtedly a lovely, really often nice, and that shouldn't really be a very football word, but a nice experience to take your daughter, your child to. And that's only really come home for me since I became a father. I think I sort of thought it was too sanitised, and to an extent it is, but clubs like Middlesbrough, they have a fantastic offer, as it were, for families in terms of the way the ticket pricing and what they do on a match day and how they decorate the concourse. And that was absolutely unthinkable when I started going. So I think as an attraction for something to do with your kid, it's undoubtedly better. But I just hope they fall in love in the same way, because much of what I fell in love with was how rickety it was and how much full of character it was. Whereas now, you know, you go to the Bet365, you go to the Riverside, you go to Pride Park, and they're very, very similar grounds without too much difference in character to them. So I hope people still are still falling in love with their homes of football like I did.
And on the polar opposite side of that, your match day experience, how has it gotten worse?
The lack of... The number one thing I would say is the orchestrated atmospheres the higher up you go, from the way they make players walk out, the choreographed shaking of hands, the centrally chosen music, that sapped something so important to me, which was the fast run out, the centre half captain booting the ball in the air, going out into battle like that from a tunnel beneath the ground instead of these elongated snake tunnels they have now. Just the way they used to run out into battle, and that orchestrated atmosphere continues on to after goal celebrations, where you can't just have your spontaneous moment. The chapter in the book about this is called Spontaneous Atmospheres, thinking about it, where you can't just celebrate the goal with your own organic noise. There's always artificial noise. It cloaks your ears from 2:59 and 59 seconds, and then at half time after every goal, and as soon as the game finishes at 10:05. I cannot stand that. I think it should be such an organic thing in which we are allowed to create our own atmosphere, and that is one of the very worst changes, certainly.
Okay then, I was reading the table of contents in your book. You helpfully outlined the 50 things that to some extent have gone. Some have gone completely. Some are kind of still there, lingering, depending on where you go. And what I like is some are really kind of things football fans would list as essential, things football fans really lament. And there's also kind of perhaps more Trainspottery kind of not that important, but it's still just a shame it's gone for some people kind of thing. So from the sliding scale of importance, I mean, I passed it to my dad a couple of hours ago, and he just chuckled reading some of these out, because obviously he's a lot older than me, and kind of he's read a football pink kite. I haven't in my lifetime. So of those 50 chapters, obviously you mentioned the sanitised atmosphere. What one or what other one would you say you missed the most?
Well, actually, football pinks. I know it's in the title and you just mentioned it there. But as someone who still loves newspapers now, it is a remarkable thing to think back on. And it's not so long since every town and city had one. But it's so entwined with my memory of match day, of us leaving the ground, listening to the scores in the car, and then stopping on Yarm High Street to pick up a sports gazette, which came out at 5:30. So, you know, less than 45 minutes after the game had finished, there was this newspaper with the headline about the game, a photo from the game you were at, a match report inside, and then flip over and you had every result, scoreline, minutes scored, attendance from across the country. And I know you can get that straight away on an app or a computer screen, but having that inky thrill that we had is the thing I would bring back, and the thing I definitely miss the most. So important to those memories for me early on, and I still have a collection of an awful lot of them. So that one, absolutely.
Okay, we'll move on to talk about stadiums then. Because part of this podcast is visiting football clubs and football stadiums, I obviously get to use it as an excuse to visit grounds I haven't visited before, which is always exciting when we go to a new stadium. So we've been to certainly new grounds for me have included Fleetwood Town's Highbury Stadium, Hampden Park. We did a whole episode on Queen's Park FC just to do that. So what makes you fall in love with the ground, and what football grounds would you list as your absolute all-time favourites?
I fall in love with floodlights, first of all. Four floodlights rather than the type on the roof of a stand. I don't mind those either. So I fall in love at a distance with floodlights when I spot them across the town. And then four different stands, nothing joined up too much. A main stand with its certain character and buzz, and its doorway that's labelled players and officials only, and its press entrance and the milling autograph hunters, and that sense that something's happening, people milling around that main stand, and a terrace behind a goal, it goes without saying, a pixelated scoreboard upon the roof. My very favourite thing, which is lesser spotted, is a terrace alongside the ground, so a paddock terrace running alongside the pitch rather than behind the goal, with seating above it. That's a majestic thing to me. So therefore, the grounds I would recommend are Brunton Park, Carlisle, because that still has it. But most of my favourite grounds now are in Scotland, actually. It's been a privilege living up here, travelling around. So you've got Capilau, the home of Greenock Morton. That is the perfect football stadium still. It even has the industrial crane behind the away goal, so it speaks to what that town was like when it was a shipbuilding town and a mercantile town. That remains a great example. Somerset Park United is the type of ground that should be listed by Scottish Heritage or whoever the right people are. And Palmerston, the home of Queen of the South, is well worth a trip as well. Three sides of that are absolutely perfect, Sabutio Stadium style. So I'm totally in love with the characterful grounds and what they give and the amount of art that's within them, and those are examples of those.
I'll give you some examples of mine, and you can maybe agree or disagree and see what you make of these choices. These are just ones that have come into my head now that I've been to whilst talking to you. I'm so glad you mentioned Brunton Park, because I don't know why that terracing seating thing is so satisfying, but it is.
Yeah, it's strange. I know, I can't explain it.
Because it makes crap grounds look like they have two tiers, which is maybe it's that.
Yeah.
Some of my favourites that came into head then were Bramall Lane.
Oh yes,
I think might be the most recent ground I visited.
Yeah.
Kind of right in the heart of the city.
Yeah.
Well, close enough to the heart of the city.
A real sense of drama about Bramall Lane, isn't there, as you come down the hill and see it,
A proper cop as well. Something that's great to... you don't really want to be in there and get the full pillar in your face, but you don't mind being in one of the other stands looking at it.
Yes, exactly. It's a great spectacle,
Another one of my favourites, Kenilworth Road.
Oh, yeah.
Which is great as an away fan because you have to go through houses to get into the away end.
Three football books ago, I did a book called Hatters, Railwaymen and Knitters, where I went to 12 weekends across England, going to observing the town and the team and the social history and the football history. And Bramall Lane and Kenilworth were both. I remember the social club behind that same goal was particularly good at Kenilworth Road, the Bobbers or something like that, anyway. But yes, it's a fascinating little place.
And at the other end of the scale, Villa Park is always...
Magnificent still. I was there at for the second leg of our failed playoff campaign last season, and I'd forgotten that even with an all-seater Holt End, it is quite something, and it was extremely loud that night as well. That's a proper place.
And on the opposite end of the scale then, do you have any least favourites?
I suppose just the newer grounds that you... I mean, I've come to love our newer ground. It's the Riverside has got more shabby now, and they've made it more characterful with statues and various graphics and things like that. But there's nowhere... It's the memory I always dislike, so the horrible away defeats that stick with me rather than the grounds. There's always something to be excited by and admire in a football ground, I think.
Yeah, you mentioned there about the newer stadium's not very, very good, and certainly our ground, the Bet365, it's taken a long time for people to just get used to it, because it's not, it's very kind of identical and could be any number of other football stadiums. But I was seeing a video of Spurs' new ground this week, and that looks something else. Despite, you know, people will always have that emotional attachment to White Hart Lane, but it takes something special now with the newer stadiums to really take your breath away, because, for example, the Emirates and Wembley could be one and the same stadium, really.
Yeah, and what's been lost... I mean, Highbury was never the loudest stadium when I went anyway, but the quietness that you can experience in the vast stadiums like the Emirates, I worry that that'll be the same at the new Spurs ground, as all the headlines are grabbed by the cheese ticket you can buy and things like that, the cheese board and the viewing windows. I hope they keep some sense of how noisy White Hart Lane could be, but only time will tell.
Are you a football completist? Do you attempt to do the 92, or have you done the 92? Do you collect things from games? Do you have programmes stored anywhere? Do you do anything kind of list ticky kind of thing?
I will attempt to do the 92 when I'm older and have fewer responsibilities, and I've got through most of the Scottish League ground since I've lived up here. I'm very much driven by grounds I'm interested in, that's the problem. So I've never been to the new St Mirren ground because it architecturally doesn't interest me, where I was at Love Street, the old one, because it was this kind of ground we're describing. But I'm certainly a hoarder of things. I recently had to clear out my mum's house because she was moving somewhere smaller, and actually, that became a bit of an inspiration for Black Boots and Football Pinks, because I found all of these old, whether it's pink newspapers, fixture lists, Sabutio figures, pro set cards that were probably from before you were born, a sort of interim thing between Panini stickers and whatever came next. So yes, certainly I've got an overwhelmingly large and pointless collection of Middlesbrough memorabilia in particular that I've somehow got away with keeping in my house. Now, I stopped buying programmes at most games a few years ago, but from about 88 to 08, I would say, I've got every home programme, and I'm frightened that one day I'll become obsessed enough again to try and collect what I don't have. That's a worry that I'll never confess to my wife, though.
Every chapter in this could be worthy of a conversation in itself, but I'll just ask you to pick a number between 1 and 50.
Yeah, 17.
Okay, because I think you might know what what the each chapter might correspond to. I'm going to add 5 to every number.
That's fine. I actually don't. But carry on. Okay. I like it. It's a good idea.
So adding 5 to that gives us 22. Terrible goal kicks and foul throws. Why do you miss terrible goal kicks and foul throws?
Well, this is one of those ones where I would say the past wasn't necessarily better, but I do, you know, you look at the brilliance of Jordan Pickford's kicking out from the goal, for instance, and you couldn't dispute that that's a work of art at times. And yet, I miss the sort of tubby, smaller goalkeeper wellying it as best he can, and then it just going, it either falls short of the halfway line or it goes straight out of play. And there's just something comforting yet again as a fan to think, I could do this. I could be a player. Ditto foul throws, because we don't get many of them anymore. And just those little moments where you felt like you might be as good as the players, absolutely unrealistic and ridiculous. But those little things that about old football that I really miss. We watch these superstar sinewy athletes now and they're almost infallible, and I miss the awfulness of that kind of thing.
But it is kind of perhaps even more heartwarming when one of the world superstars or one of the great players
does something
completely
like that.
Does something completely
very true, very
relatable.
True. Yes,
I was listening to something with Gary Neville today, and he was talking about Hugo Lloris's mistake in the World Cup final is just typical of so many Sunday League keepers, but he's kind of gotten away with it because France won the game, and that's been forgotten now. And
yeah.
Karius again in the Champions League final. Obviously, a different outcome for Liverpool. But I've seen goalkeeper that happens to goalkeepers at primary school. They just roll it out, and there's an opposition forward ready to kick it straight in.
Yeah.
Players being crap is it's not supposed to be the point of football, but
no,
it's
really
very much enjoyable. Give us another number.
31.
Okay, 31 plus 5 is shabby training grounds.
Shabby training grounds. That is because, well, the training ground now is really in full view. If you watch Sky Sports News and they've got a story, they'll go and film at the training ground and you'll know all about these great complexes. I think Man City's last week was compared to you know, it's just this perfect modern place with everything going, all the money put into it. It's this super structure of a place. So I loved before that they were so secretive, so you might know the name of a few. And when you did see them, it was in the back background of a photo, a rare photo of a training session, and you'd be able to see the housing estate they were in the middle of, the barbed wire over the fencing behind them, the shrubbery. There were always, if you even had a training ground, I mean, Middlesbrough, as I say in that chapter, trained on a beach and in the prison grounds and things like that before we had one of these super training grounds. And I missed the mystery around that. So you didn't really know where it was. You'd had a mate who'd been and got autographs there, so he said. But generally, training grounds were mysterious. They were out of view, and now they're all over Sky Sports News. And I loved that sense of mystery. You would never know what went on in the magical training ground.
And we'll do one more of these from the Football Pinks book. And can we have one more number then, please?
I'll say 10.
Okay, 10 plus 5. Okay, this is interesting. Shirt etiquette.
Yeah, I wish I'd had a better title for that. Some of them are a bit let down. It can be that you just can't find the right title. But the main one in shirt etiquette is numbers 1 to 11. And that's another a bit of an old man thing to go on about as well. But the thing I loved about players having numbers 1 to 11 was how easily identifiable they were and how much the player could become their number. They were synonymous with all of this. And I know there are these players who've copyrighted their high squad numbers and all of this still, but there was just something about 1 in goal, 3 at left back, 2 at right back, 4 and 5 at centre halves, and this knowing where you were. It does sound tremendously old man. And then the other side of shirt etiquette being wearing the right, you know, wearing your away kit only when you need to and things like that. I mean, we've gone through something this season. I was down at Hull to watch Middlesbrough away, and there was a video came out at 1:30 to announce that we were playing in a brand new, totally unnecessary white third kit, which would be priced at £75, limited edition. And that was the absolute height of this kind of thing, of bad shirt etiquette.
Going to kind of ask you about like your kind of typical match day experiences. First of all, your match day experience when you're not at a game, say
your team's away from home and you just haven't you haven't worked out any other game to go to, maybe there's just not a feasible option to go to. So you're perhaps you're sat at home, perhaps you go to the pub. What would your kind of football consuming habits be on a Saturday when your team's not available to watch?
I know I'm impossible to live with. I'm grumpy on a Saturday because deep down I know I shouldn't be at home. I should be at a game, and I'm only content when I'm at a game or a ground. But unfortunately, real life does interlope sometimes. So for me, it would be consuming a lot of football news via newspapers, proper old-fashioned paper newspapers in the morning. And if I'm allowed television access, it would always be at home watching Soccer Saturday, because I think that's about as close as telly's got to making a different and exciting way of watching the game. But I would also flick between that and Radio 5, because when they're on song, there's nothing quite like listening to Five Live football coverage, and there's just something so special about football on the radio. I'm not a great consumer of football on TV, which says a lot, because I think that's more because I enjoy watching the crowd and all of the things going on around it rather than the tactical misdemeanours and things. And so, yes, a Saturday is newspapers and Soccer Saturday with a bit of Five Live in there too.
Yeah, football on the radio is a fantastic thing, particularly on... I'm picturing winter nights, perhaps driving away from a football match and hearing it can be a big game usually, and if there's a lot going on and the proper commentators on radio, I think not like TV.
Right.
There's something different about it. I'm glad you mentioned Soccer Saturday as well, because I think kind of as we move into Saturday 3 p.m. your other book, that is one of the best, possibly the best innovation Sky Sports have done for football, is introduce that programme, because Jeff Stelling has become part of people's lives and kind of maybe just he's become part of football watching furniture. Every football fan, and many who aren't football fans, know who Jeff Stelling is now. And there is something great about that programme where we can't see any football at all. We're watching Phil Thompson watch a game, we're watching Paul Merson watch a game, and we're seeing the scores come in from Scottish League 2, and Stelling will reel off a fact about who's just scored for Adrianians.
As a concept, it doesn't work. And yet, as you say, it's the best football on television we've had for a long time. It stands really on Jeff Stelling, as you're saying. His knowledge. He's a brilliant broadcaster in his own right, but he's also one of us. It helps that he supports a lesser team in Hartlepool United, I think. But that knowledge and interest and passion, that's almost unheard of. We have so many bland broadcasters. He's definitely one of us, and I think we relate to that so much. We love him anyway, Jeff being from the Northeast. I remember him on BBC Cleveland and Tees and things, but also because some years ago when Middlesbrough was voted to be the worst town to live in, he gave this fantastic rant that most of us can reel off word for word. So he's a legend in our
and
eyes.
Journey South,
strange one that. I hoped he could have come up with some slightly better names, but there you are. I'm nitpicking.
Yeah, that was absolutely fantastic. So when you do go to a game, then say you're going to a Middlesbrough home game, what is your routine around that? Do you get there early? Do you go to the pub before and after? Do you have something to eat in the ground? What is your kind of typical match day routine, if you have one?
Well, my days are long and hungry with travelling down from Edinburgh. So by the time I get to Middlesbrough, I try to get there to meet my friend at about 11:30, 12:30. So I'm already starving and ready for a pint. So a couple of pints in Middlesbrough, always in the same pub, in the same seats, in that classic football ritual way. Walk the same route, buy my fanzine off Rob, the fanzine editor, as I have done for 20-odd years. All about the ritual, the routine. And the consumption of pints continues at half time, and then afterwards as well. So it's a good day out from up here, as you can imagine. The train journey can be long after a defeat, but a fairly glorious, nice bit of time to myself with newspapers after a win.
Fanzines, another thing you mentioned, that this kind of slowly considered to be on the way out, but there's still quite a hardy bunch of them that are still going strong. I mean, Stoke have two, Duck and the Oatcake. It's always a great thing to see a fanzine doing well at another club.
I feel like the ones that have survived are going to continue now, actually. Middlesbrough, Fly Me to the Moon, has just reached its 30th year at the weekend there. And I think, hopefully, we've lost all the ones we're going to lose. And there are a number of new ones. And interestingly, our Ultras group, the Red Faction, brought out their first fanzine a couple of weeks ago. So I thought it was really interesting that lads aged 17 to 24, 25 were interested in doing something in print. And they got an exclusive interview with Steve Gibson, which was quite a coup, I thought, as well. So I didn't do a chapter on fanzines because I don't want to put the death knell on them. And I think they're going to last, and we'll always have when Saturday comes anyway.
Yeah, possibly the proudest achievement of my life has been writing an article for when Saturday comes.
Yes, it's a lovely moment, that, isn't it? I've done a few and had nice book reviews, and yeah, that's still a special thing for us, isn't it?
I've actually got three copies of the one I'm in right
next
to me.
Yeah, I always do that still now, so there's no shame in that.
So, We'll talk about that. We've talked about some of the things you miss about the old school game, if you like. So we'll talk about things you love about the modern game then.
Yeah.
Whether they're things that have carried on or whether they're things that have changed. So we'll do the same thing for Saturday 3 p.m. That we did for Black Boots and Football Pinks. Give me a number between 1 and 50.
Yeah, I'll go 33.
So 33. Plus 5, 38, Footballese. What is Footballese?
Yes, a strange title. I should have just called it The Language of Football or something. But as far as I remember, Footballese being the strange dialect that exists only in football writing. Things like penning a new deal and issuing a come and get me plea. Because I see them nowhere else in the English language. And they're very unique to the game. And they're just the strangest phrases that you can't escape from. And there'll be times when you're writing yourself and you think, oh, I really want to use that. Is it perfectly encapsulated? Yes, but certainly issuing a come and get me plea is my perfect example and my favourite one of those.
We should at this point mention the Twitter account Football Clichés. Traded in these, because it points out so many that you just kind of, You just breeze past,
yes,
because you've become so ingrained. You've heard them so often that you don't really think about the phrase and how daft it is. Like the angle of post and bar. Yeah. Nobody talks like that in real life, but yet in football it's
brilliant.
It's fine.
Yeah.
I love the cliches and stuff around football. They're a whole podcast in themselves. So. We'll quickly move on to another one, another number between 1 and 50.
I'll go 12.
Okay, 12 plus 5, 17 catering vans.
Oh.
Something that you don't associate with the high-flying corporate stadia, very much.
But the intrinsic, part of football. Yeah, the intrinsic value, I suppose, is in the smell, because often we associate certain smells with football, our smell memory as humans being so strong. And the one that's always named is fried onions. And without the catering van, we wouldn't have that. Or whether you eat from them or not is a different matter. I've been vegetarian for 4 or 5 years, and eating at football is nigh on impossible very often. But it doesn't stop me appreciating these wagons that you only otherwise see at car boot sales and fairs and things, with names like Hollywood Grill and things like that. And they're just part of that matchday furniture, I suppose, that ritual. They're unfolded outside a football ground. It's the theatre of it all. And without them, and without the lottery sellers and the programme sellers, there wouldn't really be a sense of occasion. And they're absolutely integral to that. From the smallest ground you go to, there's always a van, to the, when they're lined up at the larger grounds. Always taking that vital income away from the clubs, and yet there's something extremely endearing about them.
Absolutely. I'm reading some of the other titles in that book, and there's plenty we can go into. But I think, given that we've got Christmas approaching, the hectic Christmas schedule is one of the delights of the modern game, but it's very much under threat. What have you made? What do you make it of seems the to be annual manager complaint?
Yes, it's exactly that, isn't it? It's the annual manager's complaint. I love it for so many different reasons. Things like getting out of the house when you're thoroughly sick of your family, right through to one of those rare times in life when you're having a better time than the footballer on the pitch. You spend all your years being jealous of him because he's got to be a footballer. He gets paid money to do this wonderful thing. And for once, you've got one up on him, because you know on Christmas Day he's training, as you'll be told again and again in the press conferences. And just that Schadenfreude element of a football fan, which is a terrible thing. But in itself, it's brilliant. It moves the season on so quickly. It's such an important thing from the week before through to the FA Cup third round. It just shifts things on. You know where you are a bit after. If you have a good Christmas, it can determine so much. The games every day. Just getting yourself out of the house, or even just getting Jeff on to be able to watch the scores coming through, tinted with all that happens at Christmas, I think it's the most special thing, and I don't think it'll ever disappear entirely. Sadly, mainly because the TV revenues would be hit.
Yeah, of course. Daniel, thank you very much. There are so many topics that appear in both books that I'd gladly speak to you for hours about.
Likewise.
Perhaps that'll have to wait for another time. But we'll leave people wanting more then. Where can people buy your latest book?
I sell direct on my own website, which is danielgreywriter.com. But otherwise, they're in your Waterstones and all the usual online places.
Okay. And we'll ask you then, what game are you going to next?
My next game, on Saturday, I'm due to go to a game with Harry Pearson, the great football writer, and a great writer in general, and we've never been to a game together, and I don't know which game it is yet, because he goes to see Northern League games, and he's choosing on the day which bus we're going to take from Newcastle, and then the week after that I'll be at Brentford to stand watching the Borough.
Okay. I'm off to crew myself for the first time ever. Again, speaking of grounds you see from trains, you always see crew.
You certainly do. Stand at Gresty Road. I love that. Yeah.
Yeah. For the first time, I'm actually getting off and going inside. So enjoy your weekend.
Yes, likewise.
I'll hopefully enjoy mine. And thank you very much for coming on. Who are you?
Thank you. Thanks for having me.
In an age where new, better financed football podcasts spring out of the ground regularly, we really appreciate all the support you can give independent projects like this one. So with that in mind, if you could leave a review on iTunes or give us a shout on social media, we'd really appreciate it.